Hello and welcome to It's All About Choices. This is the show where my guest and I discuss our lives and our careers framed through the choices we've made, the good and the bad choices. My name is David Barrow, and I work as an enterprise service management consultant. 2023 will mark my 30th year in the workplace. This is a career that started upon leaving school with very few qualifications. And really, a mere passing interest in information technology. I didn't set out to do this job, and I didn't really set out to do any of my first few jobs. Those 30 years have flown by, and it's through a mixture of luck, judgment, and some questionable choices that I find myself where I am today. During this series, my guests and I will reflect on the choices we have made that have led us to today, as well as our future choices. And we don't do this just for ourselves, but we do it because we think it'd be great to share these experiences to help others on their career journeys who may face similar choices to those we have faced across our multiple career paths. Each episode of It's All About Choices will begin with a period of my own journey, and my guest will be somebody I first met at that time. My guest today is Arthur Barnes. Arthur and I first met in 2015. At the time, I had chosen to give up the security of full-time employment to take on a role as a self-employed contractor. Not only was I giving up a good job, but I was also choosing to work in an area that was a whole new part of the industry to me, that of IT security operations. At the time, I'd spent the best part of 5 years wondering whether to give up full-time employment. I was unhappy, but choosing to do that was a really big choice and probably the best professional decision I've ever made, though at the time it did not feel that way. It turned out that working with Arthur and all of his colleagues was absolutely fantastic. I got to learn all about IT security operations and so much more, and I got to help them turn this security piece into a service. So please join Arthur and I as we discuss the choices that led to us working together, those we've made since, and how learning from failure is vital to ongoing success. If you are watching live via YouTube or LinkedIn, please feel free to ask questions or just pop by to simply say hello. It's all about choices. Hey Art, how you doing? I've instantly referred to you as Art because that's how we converse with one another. Arthur, how are you? Happy New Year.
You've really earned the right to call me Art. You've known me a very long time. Happy New Year. It's lovely to see you. Haven't seen you in ages. This is actually, I'm genuinely honored that you asked me to be a part of this. So thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. I think when it comes to that period of my career, you are one of several people in that organization who were so welcoming to me and understood that maybe there was something I could offer, but I needed to learn an awful lot about the area that you worked in, which is or work in, which is IT security, which is where we met in 2015 for an education company. Myself working as a service management contractor. My first time working as a contractor, but you were leading at the time a global threat and forensics team. But before we talk more about that period, I'd love to explore the choices that you made that led you to that day and tell us about what you do.
Well, firstly, your intro was amazing because there's a lot of similarity. I left school not really knowing what I wanted to do, actually. I did have a variety of weird and wonderful jobs, and I think it only really crystallized for me when my girlfriend, now wife, said to me, "Look, you've tried lots of things and you're not massively happy. What is it you really, really want to do?" And kind of, I said, "Look, I'm fascinated by computers. This is the thing I want to do." And I was genuinely worried. I didn't feel, I wasn't sure what my entry point into that world would look like because I felt you needed a degree. It's that classic thing, and this still applies today. I need 5 years experience to get an entry level job. That kind of, that was the thought. I was genuinely apprehensive. And an employer at the time decided to take a risk on me, not because of what I knew, but because of the kind of person I am. Anyone who I like presenting, I'm a bit of a show off. I like talking. I don't pretend otherwise. And they were setting up a Microsoft practice, the dreaded MCSE exam. And they really supported me through finding my feet in an organization, getting some accreditation, learning the ropes, and very much like a pre-sales kind of role. And after a year of that, they went, "We think you'd be great in security." And then they sort of just threw me into the deep end of, and this is not security now. This is firewalls. This is very basic. This is sort of network security. You know, people were selling checkpoint firewall boxes and making a small fortune. And after a year or two of that, and it was, you know, pre-sales, a little bit configuration, I learned networking. I learned loads of skills. And the one thing I've always done, just hoovered up the information around me. Mm-hmm. After that, I went to a consultancy, a really small consultancy filled with probably some of the brightest people I've ever worked with. And a lot of them were ex-government types who, and this is a common theme in security, you'll find a small group of very bright, independently minded people who go off and set up a consultancy because it's a great way to, you know, earn some money. They had a bit of the business that was sort of selling hardware and services and this consultancy thing, and had a pen testing team. And they seemed to actively encourage me to try my hand at all of these things. And I love doing pen testing. And some of the testers I worked with then have gone on to do truly remarkable things in the industry. Really extraordinary. But that was, you know, I was never limited to, you know, there was never really a thing of stay in your lane. One of my favorite comments about me at the time was I was their consultant of last resort. So no one else would tackle it. So art says, give it a go. And so I learned to be a pen tester with some brilliant people. And again, that's one of those skills everyone thinks is, you know, sort of digital dark arts. It's a discipline. It's something that you need a process, and you need a mindset to get an outcome. Mm-hmm. That was extraordinary. Then did sort of consulting work on government security standards, because that's the background of that company. And they did that smart thing of, they would sort of, you know, do the Jedi thing. You'd have an older guy who knew everything, and he'd bring along his little sidekick, his Padawan, and then I would learn everything while they were doing their bit. And then at some point I was allowed to go off into the wild on my own. And so that was just, and genuinely, I think that was probably one of the most, that is probably the most pivotal part of my journey, is that experience, learning about the technology, learning about process, learning about testing, and all of that was wrapped up in, you know, an experience where lots of customer facing stuff. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the M word at the beginning, making lots of mistakes. Some were hilarious. You know, learning a lot, you know, some less so, but you know, it was a really remarkable environment to make those kinds of mistakes. And to really get that sort of that really broad experience of security, because you're doing a bit of audit, you're doing a bit of consulting, you're doing a bit of policy development, and you're off doing some testing, and then you're off talking to someone about intrusion detection systems and or identity and access management, and you get equipped with this, you know, this sort of admittedly fairly thin but incredibly broad veneer of security knowledge. After that. So after that, I think I went off to a bigger consultancy, which is a bit more constrained. And then I got involved with the F word, which is forensics, working for Cyber Trust, now Verizon. Forensics is probably the most misunderstood discipline in information security. There's even the use of the word, it's got a certain amount of glamour, hasn't it? You know, yeah. I work in forensics. you know, dun dun, you know, CSI Wilston High Road. But it's very much like testing, but it's kind of looking the opposite way down the telescope. You're really trying to understand what has happened. You're not looking for the outcome. You're usually starting with this thing has happened. Yeah. Now, we need to go back and back and back and back and back. What most people seem to think is that, you know, I sit here with a glass of something, and potentially even a cigarette, and, you know, through sheer force of brilliance, I somehow deduce what's gone on. It's rarely like that. It's mostly crawling over logs for hours and hours and hours, mm-hmm. Working with incredibly bright people to test hypothesis after hypothesis. And this is not a 30-minute or a 60-minute TV show where at the end everything is neatly wrapped. Often you have to go to in this case it was customer facing service, and say things like, we didn't get an outcome for you, I'm not sure what happened here, by the way, here's the bill.
Yes, yeah, tough message.
We tried. Or, you know, we get you sit in a room with people who will say things like, who did this? Which is usually the least interesting part of the entire thing in forensics. Attribution is I think kind of is really difficult, very problematic, and tends to lead to really odd outcomes within businesses. You know, they start obsessing about who's attacking them, not what they can do to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. Some years doing that, and that was, again, I was phenomenally lucky. I walked into a role where they really wanted someone just to build up something interesting and sell it as a service around the world, and they had lots of very smart people already there, and it was about bringing people together, building a service, helping people to then, you know, helping salespeople to sell that service, working with consultants who were delivering it. In that one, that was where I got chased out of Sweden by an organized crime gang, which was one of those stories where you go, right, stop art, please explain. I was working on a forensics investigation for a number of banks in Sweden. And what happened was that lots and lots of cards in lots and lots of places were being compromised. I mean, it wasn't just localized to one thing. Fast forward to months of, you know, grinding through logs to find that the only common thing that these organizations had was a company that's providing help desk services that was essentially harvesting the so far so dull, right? Unfortunately, the silent partner in this Swedish business was a member of an organized crime gang. And it got quite exciting after that. And I can still remember leaving Sweden very quickly after the bank advised me that, you know, it's possible that there was a risk to life and limb. And if anyone thinks, well, that's forensics for you, that really is not. That's extraordinary and, you know, truly remarkable. But I actually, at that point, I decided I was out of forensics forever, which I know you're going to say, well, hold on a second.
I know different.
Hold on up, because that, and you know, and you know, the voice says, but that wasn't what happened to Arthur Barnes. I spent a little bit of time again back in consulting with Capgemini, which was brilliant. Revenue and Customs, Ministry of Defence, mm-hmm. all of those kind of things, doing that government consulting. I spent a brief time as a CISO for a small company, which was great. Really wonderful people working there. Again, just setting up a security business. They were acquired by another storage business who said, we don't know what to do with you lovely security people. And I went, I know what to do. And I wandered off. And then the threat intelligence piece really kicked in, because I started work for what's, I think, is now Dell SecureWorks, or it was acquired by Dell anyway, and it might have been spun off again, which is SecureWorks, which was phenomenal. Working with SecureWorks, who were, you know, a real industry leader in threat intelligence. And again, one of these terms, everyone goes, threat intelligence and forensics? Surely, you know, my God, you must be, you know, keeping the women at arm's length. It's truly, these are the sexiest terms in the industry. No, not at all. It's good old-fashioned in business intelligence. It's data that drives decisions. It's about making sure that you sort out the wheat from the chaff, that you help people understand what's relevant to their business. Any threat intelligence provider will tell you that they, you know, if you want to consume our service, that's great, but it's drinking from a fire hose. You have to do a lot of work to narrow the information that I'll go so far as to say data rather than information, to convert that data into some form of information by getting rid of an enormous amount of it, by applying it in a meaningful way and measuring the outcomes, which is, I mean, you could say that about anything in any business, really. It's just it's got the words threat intelligence on that. And I really enjoyed working there. I did a brief stint at Marks and Spencer's, which was retail. Retail is hard for security folks. Marks and Spencer at that time launched probably the biggest e-com site in Europe, as was, because they were actually selling everything to Amazon, believe it or not. And then I ended up at Pearson. And then at some point you wandered along, I think. I think that's how it works. Was that what you were expecting, or was that, I don't know. Was that
that's perfect. And I think there's some great threads to kind of we can unpick through conversation, but the first amongst those is the importance of having somebody that trusts you. You can see maybe what you can't see in yourself. So you mentioned, you know, at the beginning you were just a good communicator. And they saw what you could do and pointed you in the right direction. And then you started mining and taking the information and using it, which is very similar to myself. But also, I must share a quick story with you about pen testing as well. So I didn't know what pen testing was until I started working with you. But 5 years previously, we both worked at HMRC as well, although not together. I was leading the service management of a very high-profile revenue and customs service with a number of pen testers working for me, and I genuinely didn't have a clue what they were doing, although I thought I did until I met you.
Okay.
And then I realized, okay, that's what they were doing. and I think that is another kind of lesson to be learned, that in my case, I felt like I couldn't say that I didn't understand what they were doing because technically I was their leader. When in reality, I probably could have made my life a lot simpler if I had just sat down with one of them and said, could you just take me through what you do? And if I'd have just got rid of my stupendous embarrassment about it. But that was what made coming to work with you and the team at Pearson so good. There is just so much commonality in, for me, service management and security and threat intelligence management. You talked before about how you analyze data and you look from the outside in. When I'm looking at services, I look at customer journeys and I look at them from the outside in. There's no point in trying to understand the pain a customer's feeling from your point of view. You need to understand what they're feeling from their point of view. And a lot of what I apply today comes from the lessons I learned with yourself from actually doing that work. We had many a conversation where I was by now over my embarrassment of asking questions, possibly asking too many questions. But you were teaching me about the forensics. And that was the other thread I wanted to pick up, was the importance of utilizing somebody else's knowledge, be that a mentor or a manager who can bring you on the path. I think it's everybody who's been on the episode so far has been somebody I've taken something from and hopefully given a little bit back to latterly. But it's just important that you recognize who those people are. So we've had some comments, so I'm just gonna, and they're comments, not questions just now, but Lucy's just saying how much she's been looking forward to this. So hi, Lucy, I hope you're well. Suranwan is just offering a comment that this is some great insight.
I work with Suranwan, so thank That's you for right. that, Suranwan. Yeah.
It's great to know that you guys are watching. Thank you very much. One of my questions was going to be, tell me about forensics, but you've done some of that already. So I'm going to just kind of dive into something else if it's okay. So when we worked at Pearson, as I'll explain, security for me was a whole new world. I kind of understood IT security as an operational perspective, threat management, forensics, intelligence, no, not so much. And I had the same kind of CSI vision to forensics that you explained previously. And in fairness, I know there's probably stuff you can't share, but some of it was just a little bit, you've mentioned the Swedish piece. I know some other bits that you were doing. But that said, working with you and your colleagues made me very quickly realize that, like anything, it's a service. I say every product is a service. I see everything as a service. And you and I started sharing some common thinking that, we both believe that what we were doing was undertaking controlled experimentation built upon our experiences, but mainly our mistakes. Is that something that even now, so 7 years after we first met, you still feel that way?
Right,
And
so if the
before
question
you
is
answer that
that still,
question,
yeah, sorry, it broke up.
before, oh, sorry, before you answer that question, and I'll repeat it in a moment, just to say another ex-colleague of ours, Les, was imparted some wisdom.
Yoda himself, Les Shorter.
When you ask questions, you only appear to be stupid once. Very true. I think I was appearing to be stupid for about 5 years with those guys in HMRC. The question was, is we found commonality in that we understood we were doing controlled experimentation, but mainly that was built upon mistakes we've made. Do you still feel that way all these years later, that that's still the case?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know of another way of solving the problems that I face every day, because the one thing I will say about my job is it's not the same 2 days running. Okay, now we will write playbooks, we will develop automation, we will find ways to simply address simple issues. Absolutely, and a critical part of what we do. I can't recruit enough people, I can't train enough people, so I have to use playbooks, automation, repeatable processes. And they are very good, as I say, at solving if then when type problems. It's not a problem. That's we can do that. And a lot of what I do is just minimizing the number of those simple problems for lots of reasons. Firstly, it's a great way to control cost. I don't have lots of people running around chasing tickets. So that's great. It's also a great, it's good for the team members. I don't want anyone in my team doing really, really dull, repetitive work. They will. I'd love to say it's because I care so deeply about them. That may be true, but what's really important is I want them to stay, learn and grow and contribute more. And they won't do that if they're given the same old boring stuff to do day in, day out. Critically, what it allows me to do, though, again, even that is about sorting out the signal from the noise. In all of these boring tasks, there may be something interesting that we want to pick further at, because security is again. Often I think we're positioned as the defenders. We're sat there waiting for an attack to happen, and then we spring into action. That's not true. Attackers don't work like that. We don't work like that. I have a full-time job. I can't wait for someone else to make a move. I've got to assume they've made a move. I've got to assume something bad has happened, and I've got to be very proactive about sorting that out. And often that I will pull at threads that go nowhere, an enormous amount. Stuff pops up in logs. Art, have you seen this before? Because as the person that's in charge, you're often, everyone expects you to know the answer. And by the way, I've seen some brilliant leaders, and I can think of one in Pearson in particular, who was spec even though, and it's she hopefully will know who I'm talking about. She was a very senior individual, but I'd seen her out with a giant, printout of an event of all the logs associated with the event going through with a highlighter and trying to figure out what had happened. That's not changed. We still do that. We have more tools to sort out the signal from the noise, but let's be the traffic is more. The attackers have learned more. Hopefully we've learned more. We've got better tools. We've got our stuff. But we will miss things. And it will only become apparent we've missed them when something terrible is, something serious kicks off. We will find things and we will not learn from them as quickly as I would like. And not only that, we will find things and say to maybe system owners, could you stop what that is, because that's driving us crazy, and then discover that that particular thing is making us millions of dollars in money. So you're going to have to suck it up and work out a way around that. I think the thing that I've learned most in all of this time is the patience to help others understand this. I was never a particularly patient individual. I think that, you know, people who work with me will have their differing opinions on that. But I think now I really work hard to adopt a patient and thorough mindset to help people understand it's okay to make mistakes. What I will say is, it's okay to make mistakes. It's not okay if you keep making the same mistake over and over again. It's a critical difference, right? You and I both, we've both made mistakes. I've made lots. I try not to repeat them. And if I find someone's making the same mistake over and over again, you know, what can you do? We'll talk to them, we'll coach them, we'll help them. And that's fine. But in a job where making mistakes is a great way, is an indication that you're growing, if they're making the same mistakes, they're not growing. And as someone who's a manager and a leader now, I look at that very carefully to try and understand maybe why they're not. Is it not, you know, because, and it comes down to this thing as well. There are times when making a mistake is, so for example, a forensic investigation, one of the biggest single challenges with an investigation is dealing with all of the lawyers.
Yeah.
You will be dealing with the lawyers 2 years after you've completed an investigation. At Pearson, I spent as much time talking to lawyers as I did anybody else in the business. In fact, I suspect more. Mm-hmm. And so when you have to explain to those individuals who have fine minds, who are specialists in arguing, what the mistake that you made, that can be quite interesting. Because to them, that is not a learning opportunity. That is, oh, great, we're going to be made mincemeat in court.
Yeah.
Yeah, or this is going to look bad. Or why did we choose that decision? It's one of the reasons why when we talk about forensics and I see anyone with forensics on their resume or their CV, I always get a little twitchy if I can't see evidence that they've really done it to a level where they've had to give evidence, they've had to provide documentation to lawyers, they've had to be really tested on it. Because the one thing I'll say about forensics is if you are not following a process to the letter, it's not forensics, it's poking a computer. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting is there's very little latitude for creativity on that alone, because you can't just deviate. Testing, if you see something interesting, you can chase it. Yeah, let's go down that route. Not really the case with things like forensics. You can't make things up. So what I find is that you know, my mindset is probably better tuned now for the world of forensics than it ever was, but it's not what I do anymore, or not day to day. I'd rather help other people go down that route. Anyway, sorry, as usual, I ramble.
No, I think it's because what you were talking about there was, you know, the breadth of your experience and the mistakes and learning from those mistakes is what enables you to do the role well. And as I did the promotion for this, I talked about where the worlds of ITSM and SecOps can come together. It's exactly the same there. We have knowledge management. And I remember working with you and us discussing the concept of knowledge management and making knowledge accessible and shareable so that others could take those mistakes and learn from them too. And so that we could actually make that knowledge useful across the organization and lift it from being just a forensic piece of knowledge to an organizational piece of knowledge and something that you could learn from, you know, long after you and your team departed from the organization.
Just on that, just so you know, David, one of the folks who was in Sri Lanka, who was part of the forensic threat, he's doing my job now. Fantastic. After I've gone.
Perfect.
Okay. And no matter what kind of outcomes I got from the work that I did, I couldn't be more proud that we had a team member who was so committed, a brilliant individual, an absolute pleasure to work with. And he moved through the organization, becoming a local manager, becoming very much my, you know, sort of right-hand man. He relocated to the States. He, you know, when you talk about making choices, you know, it's not just about me learning from the people who I, you know, senior to me or my peers. I remember
Sorry, I didn't mean to show loose teaser.
That's all right.
Comment then, but it's good.
It is very good. No, you're quite right, Lucy, to go down that route. But that was the bit that's made me proudest of my time in Pearson, is that individual has gone on to do great things. He always was going to do great things. But, you know, it's really, and it is, you can learn from, you don't, you know, your thing about don't ask, I don't want to ask that question. I think one of the things I've learned most is I don't mind asking questions of my peers or the people more senior to me, my leadership, but I ask questions of my, you know, about what my team are doing and how they're doing it, why they're doing it, and can they make that, can they explain that to me? That's okay. It's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And that individual, as I said, you know, that was the case in point. I haven't really thought of myself as being that word leader and what it means until we had someone come along who grew through the roles to become a manager and a leader in his own right. At that point, I think, okay, I think I've earned my spurs as an actual leader there.
I agree. I think even as a consultant now, my aim when I leave any gig, so to speak, is to have educated and assisted those who will remain after me and hopefully help them to elevate themselves to wherever they want to be. And I can completely see how that happened with you at Pearson, because as I said, your explanation, your coaching was such that I could understand it. And you knew the right level to pitch to me based on what I was doing, like you knew the right level to pitch to a lawyer based on their requirements. So I think that's a great indictment of your leadership. And I would also say your skills, which I know leadership could be considered a skill, but I think sometimes how you implement the skill is not necessarily leadership. It can be you can be doing too as opposed to leading.
I was going to say, I see a lot of very bright engineers moving into management, and it's not for them, and that's not their fault. They shouldn't be moved if you don't want to do this. And I didn't want to do leadership, I didn't want to do management for a very long time. I think I was very lucky at Pearson and where I am now to have people around me who are able to help me with, I think one of the biggest single challenges with leadership is personal maturity, which is a very difficult thing to measure, right? I'm an eternal child, but at work I can't afford to be that guy. So I have to, you know, you have to consider other people's opinions, what's right for the business, how do we get the most out of folks without, through inspiration, not manipulation, how do we help people on their journey? So those are all big, big questions. But anyway, I'm learning every day, as they say at Pearson.
or always learning, yeah.
Always learning. Stole it from
So before we go ahead, I just want to firstly show a comment and then give Lucy some airtime, because I popped Lucy's comment on screen by mistake, but I want to make sure it's read out so anyone listening can hear that. But before we do that, we've had a comment from Sahini saying, go Art.
It's all right. She works with me now. She's amazing. Another candidate, a future CISO. Potentially, the other thing is, and again, on the personal side, Sahini does amazing work in the third sector. She does work for charities as well.
Oh, wow.
No, she's, I mean, I did say to her,
so probably, go Sahini, that's great.
Absolutely. A truly remarkable individual, because she does things like she helps with school, helps folks in understand cybersecurity in schools. She did during lockdown, and this is the most wonderful thing, she and a bunch of her friends got together to read audio, to convert regular books into audio books for blind students in India.
Oh, wow.
So she's an extraordinary individual, and you know, it's very kind of her to say something nice about me, but she's genuinely a really remarkable person.
That sounds amazing, Sahini. I take my hat off to you. That's an incredible thing to do. And thank you for watching. And then back to Lucy, who I hurriedly popped on screen and then popped off. But let's go again. So Lucy says, that ramble was interesting. It was making me think back to when I did my degree, which specialised in forensic computing. I'll be honest, I think I'm quite glad I went down the service management route with a winky smiley face. Well, I'm glad you went down the service management route, Lucy, because it's great to have you as part of our industry, and it's great to have you watching. But I bet you'd have been amazing at forensics too, because your attention to detail is such that you probably would have been incredible at it as well. And we have somebody that's just logged in as a user. They might need to give the studio access to their name, but I think they make a very good point, which is they would argue emotional maturity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So time is going quick. So we've got 9 minutes and a couple of other things I'd like to try and get through. But with all these comments, it's pretty difficult, but it's great. So this podcast is called It's All About Choices because it's about the choices we've made, but also helping others make choices, especially career choices. And certainly before I got involved in IT security, I just felt it was a bit of a nuanced career. I mean, then again, so service management in fairness. But would you have any tips, Art, for somebody looking to take that path? What would you be looking for in that person and what should they do to sort of set off on that path?
So I think there are a couple of things. Both you and I are proof that you don't necessarily need a degree in the subject. And I think that's very important. I think the other thing is, look, when I'm writing a job description, particularly if you're part of a big company, all right, you're going to write a job description that's going to have to be signed off by two HR people, a lawyer and another leader. That's how it works, right? And if you're reading that job description and think that's really what I want to do, but I think I only hit 50% of these requirements, then please apply for that job because that's actually pretty good. All right, that's pretty good. You've got to apply. Even within the organization I work within, I will have Slack messages or emails from people saying I'd like to work in your team. If you want to do something, that is good. I'm talking. There's a chap who reached out to me from Chile last year, and we chat quite regularly on Slack. He'd like to be part of my team. It's never a problem. He talks to me for 5 minutes, asks me about stuff. He's actually helping me now with something on Confluence. It's okay to take that shot. I would say one of the best things you can do is find someone in the industry and have them read your resume, read your CV, and actually have them interview you as well. Because it's really important that you get used to comfortably talking about what you do and how you do it. There is a skills shortage in information in security broadly. 2 million, with 2 million jobs, job vacancies, but it's very hard to get into. I suspect the two are not, unconnected. Mm-hmm. So, get a good resume. Work with someone to do a couple of mock interviews. My interview style: by the time you speak to someone like me now, you'll have usually spoken to a couple of other people. And what I do is I do everything I can to talk people out of the job. That's my way of interviewing them. But it's this. Now, that can be discouraging for people. And guess what? If you're discouraged by that, you can't work in my world. I get told what I can't do all the time. I get told this is a bad idea all the time. I'm looking for people to say, well, hold on a second. What about this? What about that? You've got to remember that as an interviewer, I can be bothered by your history and your background. What I'm really looking for is you're a good fit to my team. Are you going to be someone that's going to, and I would expect you not to be, I'm going to say this, maybe it's wrong. Most people are useless for the first 6 months. There's a lot to learn. You've got an entire organization to learn. You've got systems to learn. Now, is that going to be 6 months with this person? It's going to be a year. Those are the questions I'm really mulling over in my head. But you should apply. You should, and I've seen some terrible resumes. I've seen some terrible CVs. Okay. You need to think about what's on there. You need to find someone that will have a look at it, and then you need to practice your interview technique. Interviews are high-pressure situations. I had a nasty habit at Pearson of turning up to them late and being annoying during them, which sounds awful. But if you can't handle that, you can't deal with a hot incident with five people, three of whom are telling you it's not really a big deal. That I'm looking for that positive mental attitude, that I'm going to get this done no matter what you chuck at me. Because, I'm going to flip that around and say, once you're on the team, my first question in every one-to-one is, when is your next holiday booked for? Okay, when are you next taking time off? Mm-hmm. Why are you online at this time? Because I keep an eye on the times that people are logged on. You need to look after yourself. And I will spend that time with those folks. If they turn up to an, if they've got a decent resume, if they've interviewed well, I'm not looking for 15 years experience and a variety of different certs. Will you fit in? Will you help? Will you? My eldest son described me once as a professional problem solver. I'm no longer a security person or a forensic investigator. I'm just a professional problem solver. That's what I'm looking for in other people. Show people you solve problems. Does that help? I don't know. It's felt a bit generic, but, you know.
I think it's really true for security as an industry, isn't it? You know, the, like you say, you can't be sat around waiting for somebody to attack you. You need to be understanding what could come, anticipating that, and then solving the problem that may happen as opposed to the one that, that has. I think that's, again, with service management, we focus so much on being reactive that we fail to find the time to be proactive. If you can get ahead of the reaction and anticipate it, you can be proactive. And then once you're proactive, you can actually design services that, that do that for you. But it's about problem solving that gets you there. And actually, Juan H has really taken one of your points and said, cut the years of experience in half and apply anyway.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
There's no harm in applying. I'm with you on the, I will read every CV that comes across my desk, and those that seem to be a bit punchy and maybe a bit of get up and go about them, they'll be the ones that I'll normally be really looking forward to interview. It doesn't mean they're going to get the job. It just means I'm looking forward to meet them. And
absolutely. Can I just say, David, my favourite was a chap who was a kitchen fitter who applied to be in my team. Now, I was half tempted to interview him just on that basis alone to find out how where he felt the crossover was. Mm. But it's that point about, you know, what Juan said is right. Ignore the years of experience. Okay. One of the things I can't afford in my industry to say, well, you've been here 5 years, I'm going to promote you. I'm going to get you to that. You've been here 5 years now. If you've lived the same 5 years, if you've lived the same year five times, that's not 5 years experience. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Exactly.
I want people who are going to be flexible, who are going to be smart about this stuff. I don't mean overconfident. I believe I once got a job based on the number of don't knows I said in an interview. I think it was Capgemini. Someone very senior, and given who I work for now, rather, he asked me about database security, and I just said, I have no idea. I said, good, moving on. Because he didn't want me sat in front of customers bullshitting.
Yes.
If I don't know, you don't know. That's fine. We've said this before. Ask the question. It's okay to say I don't know. You know? Absolutely. And he was very good. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed my time in that big consulting firm purely because, you know, and again, their recruiting strategy was extraordinary. Do I have time just to tell one brief story? Because I think this is really important.
Yeah, please do. So
what they did, and I'm sorry to spoil the surprise for folks. I submitted my CV. I was very interested in working for them. And they said, pop down to our office this time, clear the afternoon. You know, you'll meet a few people. It'll be a bit of a chat. I turned up and there were about 30 other suit wearing, you know, junior consultancy types wandering around. And what they did was they said, look, just to tell you the format for the day, we're going to hand you all a bit of paper with a scenario on. We're going to give you a pen. You can handwrite a proposal. One page is enough. And then we're going to take you into another room with a flip chart. We've got three senior consultants there. They'll have a chance to read your proposal and then you get to present to them. And then we'll tell you how we've done. They were a third of the people walked out straight away. Because who would want that? It was overwhelming. But then they don't understand the job as a consultant like you or I do, because you're on your own. You'll be asked to do difficult things.
Absolutely.
And you'll have to, and I'd love to implement that where I work, something similar, where we ask people, well, you know, what are you going to do? And as a candidate, that's the attitude you need to bring is, okay, they're doing this now. Do I really want this job? If the answer is I really want this job, I'm not saying you have to do anything, you know, that isn't strictly by the book, but you should be able to tolerate having to deal with unusual and unexpected change, because that's the life I lead. Is, you know, I promise, but you know, by Monday my world will be different again.
Absolutely.
Something will have happened. Anyway, sorry, I digress as usual.
No, I think it's great. I mean, I'm going to pop a comment on screen and share a quick story. We've got another couple of bits to get through, so for those watching, I think we're going to take an extra 5 minutes. Hey, it's my show, and as long as you've got the time out, we can spend an extra 5 minutes. It's all good. So Daniel makes a really good point, network. speak to people who are in the position you wish to be in a year or two's time to understand what skills are required to get there. Absolutely. And I would add to that, go and find a mentor. Go and find a mentor that is doing what you want to do, who can help you get there. And also, for those of you worried about approaching somebody for a mentor, believe me, they'll be as flattered that you're approaching them as you are nervous about approaching them. And if it works well, it's a great thing to do for all parties. So I think that's an awesome comment there, Daniel. Thank you.
And I'm just going to add one thing about networking. It doesn't have to be some sort of, you know, if you adopt, again, a fairly positive mental attitude towards it, if you don't like networking, you're never going to be good at it. And I'm not saying that you need to suddenly like it. I don't like broccoli. No amount of eating broccoli is going to make me like broccoli. If you don't like networking, think of it as just a personal challenge that you're going to do this thing for 30 minutes. You're going to be this person for 30 minutes, right? Because you get jobs that way. You get, you know, the number of times when someone has reached out to me and asked, would you fancy doing this for a living? Because I like talking to people. You know what I'm like? In fact, you know, we're going to run over it and you probably have to edit it, but I like talking. Equally, I like hearing what other people's stories are. And that's okay. If you're not that kind of person, even if you just practice, get two or three questions. Ask two or three questions. And people are often very flattered to be engaged with, you know, to be asked about stuff. So, yes, brilliant comment by Daniel.
It's great. So you touched on this a moment ago around work-life balance. You work in a in a highly pressurized environment, at least it can be. I mean, it's not, obviously you've got time to do this today, but there will be occasions where I was thinking, maybe, you know, maybe I'll cancel me at the last minute because of what you do. But how does that work-life balance look to you and your teams in the real world? How do you kind of discuss that and help?
So one of the things I'm big on is encouraging people to take time off. Okay. I used to, certainly at Pearson, I had a reputation for being always available. I've my very, very patient wife, she's an artist. She's seen me grab my laptop while she's at an exhibition with some of her work, grab my laptop, find a corner and get on with some work. There was an instant breaking. To this day, I still remember the CISO at the time. He said to me, it's very noisy where you are, Art. And it was like, it's like 8 p.m. It was very noisy where you are, Art. And I said, yeah, I'm an art gallery. And I had a glass of red in my hand. And he said, and his exact quote, which was brilliant, was, I pay you too much money for you to be going to art galleries to steal their free wine. My partner, on the other hand, went, okay, this is what he does. I can remember another time we were driving back in a cab from a night out. Something kicked off. She said it was fascinating to hear me work. So she's incredibly understanding. My kids are incredibly understanding. One Christmas in three and my job is ruined. Last year it was Log4j. You know, there have been others. You have to bring everyone along in your own family. So let's talk about my team and my attitude to their time. Mm-hmm. So I pay, some of them are paid to be on call. Not all of them. The folks that are on call, I am very, very wary of the signs of burnout, because you don't have to be dealing with incidents to be burned out. It can just be that constant waiting for the other shoe to drop. You know, every time your phone goes, is this going to ruin my evening? I work very closely with the team to make sure that if they are finding, I will step in myself rather than have someone make themselves ill or, you know, struggle, or I'll ask one of my managers to step in to help. Fortunately, it's not a problem we've had to deal with so far. We've been well resourced. We've got a well-run team. We do a lot of good stuff. I think at Pearson, I was suffering from burnout quite a lot, but that was no one's fault but my own. I didn't really learn to say no until far too late in my time in Pearson. I had that kind of job where people were, you know, wow, you go and talk to him because he's done this and he's done that and he was involved in this. And it's all very flattering, but it's also very tiring. So first and foremost, prioritize time off. Secondly, I do have conversations with my team about how they're feeling and how they're coping with being on call. And that's presently, I mean, we're just literally coming off a long on-call period. And the other thing is I make it clear to them that their mental health is, and their mental well-being is important to them. But organizations will quite happily eat up people who say yes to everything and who don't look after themselves. You know, you have to be honest with them and say, you know, no job I've done, you know, if I wasn't around would have resulted in, you know, people dying. I'm not a doctor, I'm not a surgeon, I'm a bloke who works with computers. So it's okay. But when the big things do happen, and Log4j was one of them, I think it was that was a number of days on call every day coming up to Christmas. You know, you have to, the biggest single challenge is actually managing things like the handovers. I run a global team. So there's a big gap between US and India time. There's a couple extra hours in there. You know, getting people to start a little earlier and getting people to work a little bit late and trying to adjust again. And you're looking for the signs. You're looking for people who are normally little rays of sunshine suddenly arguing with one another. That never happens. So what's going on there? Or they're late and they look shattered. Okay. And asking the question, well, who else can we use to maybe take the heat off of them? Anyway, you've touched on a subject that, you know, I'm endlessly interested in because I think I'm a living bad example of how to do it. I've made an enormous number of mistakes around this whole work-life balance thing.
I think the great thing is that you're passing on the wisdom you've learned from those mistakes to your teams, and you're not allowing them to make the same mistake, and which is a good thing. And I know you wanted to touch upon this, and so I only share it because you mentioned it yourself. But obviously, you manage a health condition of your own that is, you know, isn't usually the sort of you know, stress isn't recommended as a remedy for. But you mentioned
you bringing that up. No, thank you for bringing that up. So I'm type 1 diabetic. Within my eye line are insulin jelly babies, orange juice. I'm on a call. My blood sugar could have gone catastrophically low. I would have started, and I have to manage that. And I have to manage that during an incident or during, you know, with everything that I do. What I'd say to anyone applying for jobs who hear things like, yeah, but you're constantly on call, it's really bloody hard, and you've got a health condition, my answer is you can manage it. You can do these things. I think that one of the great things to come out of COVID, and very little good did, is if you have a serious health condition and you don't want to travel into an office every day and you can manage it better at home, then this is that. Right, let do that. You know, I wouldn't, you know, companies should be looking at folks who have health conditions, who, you know, are differently abled, as a giant pool, 2 million InfoSec vacancies, right? If you don't think that having a health condition or some other sort of, you know, some other challenge in your life should prevent you from doing this. And thank you for bringing it up. It really is obviously a subject close to my heart. My son's type 1 as well. And what I try and do for him as much as for anybody else is I make it very clear to everyone in my team, I have type 1 diabetes. Mm. I make it clear that being sick is okay. It happens. People get sick. You know, and I try and act. And I make it clear as well because it can affect things like my mood. Or I can suddenly say, I need to take 5 minutes, guys, because I've got to get some sugar inside me or whatever. And I don't know if you remember, but in the office I never used to be embarrassed about whipping out an insulin pen and sticking it in my leg. And I used to warn people, obviously, and say, look, if you don't like people giving themselves injections, look away now, but that's okay. Yeah, but that's okay. I didn't try and hide it, and I don't think people should, because the other thing is it allows people around you to make reasonable adjustments for you. To I one organization asked if I wanted a fridge in building to keep my insulin there, and I said I wasn't planning on living there for a month, so I'll carry enough for myself. I was being a consultant as well, traveling through airports with needles and drugs. Learning experience. Everyone's brilliant, by the way, when you do that. Anyway, thank you for bringing that up, David.
No, not at all. I know it's important to you, and I think it's really good to, this is what this is about, is, you know, the choices we make can sometimes be influenced by things that we keep to ourselves, and actually we don't always need to do so. So we always close with a final question. And it's a simple, well, it's a simple question, not always a simple answer, but what are your next set of choices? What choices are awaiting you and your family?
We've got interesting ones. We might have an opportunity to relocate. I work for a big American company, and one of the things that's potentially on the table at any time is, do I fancy working in another part of the world? That's always difficult because there's never a good time to tackle things like that. I've known lots of people that have done those things. They've moved to different parts of the world, and I believe the hardest part is coming back. I don't think, you know, going off to some great adventure in some other part of the world is awesome. Then you come back to, I mean, well, it's fairly grey and rainy England at the moment. It can be difficult. I think that for me, you know, I've got less of my career in front of me than I have behind me. And I'm really focusing on developing great leadership talent. Not because it's a great buzzword. Here's why. Security leadership generally is not great. Lots of people who came up through the security ranks are great engineers, great testers. They have amazing technical skills, not always the best soft skills. Someone said, you know, emotional intelligence. These are not things that run deep in the pool of talent that we have. And without great leaders, not only will we not develop great talent, but we won't get a seat at the right table to make the right kind of decisions. And we need people with the soft skills to make a difference. But, you know, I know, speaking to other people, when they see a manager come along who's got lots of managerial experience and no understanding of security, there's a fairly significant amount of eye rolling and, oh God, they won't understand our job. Mm-hmm. And that is true. We're a specialism within a specialism and often within a specialism. So developing those soft skills with folks. You talk about Sahini. She's a future leader. You know, there are plenty of others, you know, who will do great things. But I want to work with more of those folks. I really want to, you know, leave a little bit of a lasting impact. The first manager who left a lasting impact on me is a chap called David Moss, who I can't even find on LinkedIn. But he gave me my first big break and it made a huge difference to me. And, you know, I would like to pass that on to as many people as possible. So that's what the future holds for me.
Brilliant. I think that's a fantastic place to finish. And I know you mean it as well, which is great because I, you know, having worked with you, and I think it's an awesome thing to give back. So that brings us to the end of the episode. I would just like to thank you, Art, for joining me today. I've found it an incredibly stimulating and interesting conversation, and I think the comments and the input from the audience prove that. For those of you that have joined us live and commented, I can't thank you enough. It's great to have you here and listening to the wisdom that Art's imparting. And with that, we shall close this episode of It's All About Choices. Art, thanks once again. I really do appreciate it. And thank you all.
My pleasure.
Until next time. Bye-bye.